Hello, welcome to the Bolotour Podcast, where we explore the great outdoors. The Bolotour Podcast is sponsored by Bolotour, the backpack and outdoor gear company like no other. With unique products like the Bolo Tarp, which is a backpack that opens up to a tarp that's also a hammock, that's also a gear organizer with pockets. It's also a pop-up tent sidewall. It's also a drain tarp, and that attaches to our Bolo Cooler or the Tactical, the Duffel, the Day Pack, and many others. So you got to check it out at bolotour.com. That's B-O-L-O-T-O-R, bolotour.com. So whether you're hiking through the highest peaks or wandering through the city streets, Bolotour's got your back. So be ready. Be on the lookout. Bolotour. All right, let's get on with today's journey.
Frankie Marcos, up in the Bay Area right now. He's in his car. He's got this very sunshine, beautiful California day, it looks like. Yeah?
It's gorgeous out here, yeah. Sexy day.
Are you in the East Bay and the West Bay? Where you at?
I'm in the South Bay right now. San Jose, Shark City. It's my hometown.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I lived up in San Leandro for about a year. You know where that is?
Yeah, East Bay, baby. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Not too far from the where the A's and the Raiders used to play long time ago. But San Jose, that's changed throughout the years. Let's go back. We go in the origin of things. Let's go to before you were born, a little bit before. You're still young, but you were born before San Jose really blew up into, like, you know, Silicon Valley, right? And was it that old restaurant there, Old Joe's or something there in San Jose?
Original Joe's.
What is it?
Original Joe's.
Original Joe's? Is that down in San Jose, right?
Yeah, the High Life is another. Henry's High Life is a staple.
Okay. So did you grow up out there?
Yeah, born and raised out here. I was here when it felt like it was San Ho back then. There was, you know, Cinco de Mayo, people were wilding out. There's like gang violence, which isn't the best, but it's at least there was culture and there was fun people around, you know, there's parties all the time, house parties, warehouse parties. There was a lot going on. And now it feels like proper Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. Backpacks on scooters and they're making 300K and they're bored and their souls are gone. And that's kind of who's here now.
Right. That sums it up right there. That's kind of like the way I look at it too. You know, San Jose was, I bring all that up. I want to get the whole texture for it. We little Frankie running around there. Were you the funny kid?
Yeah.
All right. Going to the parties. Like, hey, well, what's going to look energetic Frankie, I bet. Just running around going, hey, where's the parties at? Where, you know, what's going on there in San Jose? Were you dialed in? Were you the younger kid that acted like he was a little older than he was?
A little bit. I mean, as far as just knowing what I wanted to do, I just wanted to be funny and play basketball, and that's all I cared about. I'm the youngest kid, so I'm the selfish one. Do you know what I mean? If I'm being honest,
I'm the youngest also.
That makes sense.
A little bit, guys are selfish, not me. So, so now, where did you first do stand up, and how old were you? Where was it?
I was 22 years old. In fifth grade, I told people, I'm going to be famous one day. Let me sign that. I'm going to be famous. And then I got most funny in middle school, most funny in high school. But then I didn't actually start until I was 22 years old in the Tenderloin in SF.
Oh, where was it, near Market Street, or where was it? The Tenderloin. Yeah, I know that area. My dad used to hang out in that area.
Oh, nice. Flexing.
I mean, he liked the ladies of the night. Market Street and all that. Speaking of Old Joe's restaurant, they got one over there too, I'd say.
Yeah. 900 Larkin is the bar that I performed at.
Okay. And so is that still around?
No, it looks like the apocalypse. Now, and it's like boarded up. The sign is still there though. Like the doors are boarded up. It looks like mummies have sex in there, but it's there. The building is there and the sign is there.
So how was your first gig?
Terrible. I brought like my two nicest white friends because I knew I was going to get. If I brought my black friends, they would flame me. So I was like, let me bring my sweetest, dear, best white friends.
Yeah. Frank, you did really well. Were they even like, they like, Frankie, you know, it's your first time, you'll do better.
Yeah, they were so empathetic and kind. Like my boy Chance and my boy Matt, they were both like, oh, that's all right, man. Like, you'll get them next time. Like, you'll be all right. Just got to do it again. And it took me like 4 months to try it again after that because I hated it. It was my friend Rodney is a world-ranked chef, and he at work one day around that time, he said, you make everybody laugh at work. What the hell are you doing? Like, why aren't you doing comedy? And when he said that, my heart like sunk through my butthole because I was like, this is what I wanted to do my whole life, but I've never actually done it. So he's calling me out. So I could tell it's about to happen.
Yeah.
He said, if I give you 6 months, can you write 5 minutes and perform at an open mic? And I said, yes. So I show up to this bar and there was no mic and there was no other comedian. So I kept asking him, where's the mic? Where's the other comedians? He said, don't worry about it. Just focus on you. After 3 shots and a beer later, I'm terrified. I ask him again, where's the other comics? And he goes, it's just you. Hey, everybody, we got a comedian here. His first time trying it, blah, blah, blah. And no microphone. This small stage is probably like about like this, just outside the frame here. And I just projected to the bar in the TL. And there's like, got like some few collective small laughs. One tall guy was laughing really hard, but the rest was very like low laughs. So I hated it. And I wanted to quit immediately, but I finally came back 4 months later and bombed again. Bombed the third time. The fourth time I did okay. And then I started getting less and less shitty. And then, now I've been to like 12 countries.
Wow. That's a really great story because most comedians, yours truly included, do really well their first time and then they just fuck it up the second time and then like third time and then it's flying from there. But you can say your first time was like everybody telling you, like you got the, you're growing up that way, it's telling you, and then you're like, I just know there's something there. So you're kind of like at least had that to fall back on. It's like, oh, were all those people wrong all those years telling me growing up? But I've never heard anybody kind of just like, you know, kind of like terrible the first, second, third time. And then that's you. That's great.
Yeah.
So let's start to get into the 9th, 10th, 12th, you know, times where you're starting to, what does that journey look like for you? How often are you going up? How's that climb look for you?
Man, I wish I had somebody to guide me because the first, so like after the third one, I think the fourth one is at Agave Restaurant, some like ultra authentic Mexican restaurant with the way too loud music and 15 Mexican kids from one mom and dad, like one of those restaurants.
Yeah.
And we performed in the back of that restaurant and I was only going up once a month. And then after a year, my friend Michael Brandon goes, yo, what are you only going here? And I was like, yeah, is there other stuff? And he's like, dude, there are mics all over San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose. And I was like, but I work 2 jobs. And he's like, do you want to do comedy or not? You sound like a bitch. Like, do you want to do this? And I was like, hell yeah, I want to do it. He's like, this is what we do. We drive everywhere. And I was like, oh, I had no idea. So then I started going to the city and Oakland and, you know, different places. But so the whole first year was damn near a waste, you know? And then after that, it just, I don't know. I was terrible for a long time. My mom did acting and my dad's just a pothead mailman. So neither of those things are stand-up. You know, it's just my dad telling dick jokes and then my mom being really good at acting and like impressions, voices, faces. But none of that shit is a punchline. So early in my career, I was doing a lot of act-outs and not knowing how to write a joke for a long time. But later on, I started figuring it out. It takes me a long time. I'm slow at learning shit. But when I get good, I get really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's a lot of bombing for a long time. But I had a lot of people that loved me. I've always had the lovability. So I had a lot of people coming to my shows early on, which is, again, it's a bad thing because they're supporting you. You think you're killing it. You got 100 people at the improv backing you up. And they're fucking clapping and going crazy. I think I'm killing it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's not bad. That I can think of worse things. Yeah. But, you know, the true bombing is the worst. at least you got friends. Like, you know, I got by with this one, you know? So yeah. You know what? One thing that I think is, you know, stand-up comedy can be lonely unless it's really nice. I don't know if we, you know, some comedians take it for granted, but when you got to go do a gig, or, you know, you got those particular places you like to go to, and you see your other fellow comedians that are there, you know, that you usually see. So if you do have a bad night, it's like, hey, bro, here's, and you got a good tag for you. You know, here's this or that, you know. It makes it a little easier. As yeah. to where, you know, if you don't have a good set now, usually, to me, the best way to get over a bad set is do another set right away, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So, I mean, that's now, what's going on with you right now? Are you staying in the Bay Area and like kind of working out there and performing there? Or are you just doing a lot of traveling right now? What's going on with you?
So last year was the first time that I went overseas. And I had such a blast. Like, it felt like half vacation, half, you know, comedy. And I enjoyed it so much because it just gave me, like, going to Australia, Southeast Asia, it gave me something new to talk about. You know, when you're home, you tend to get in the same sort of schedule, so you don't really have shit to talk about. So I kind of decided that every year I'll go to Australia in January through somewhere around April, and then do Asia as well, to explore, write, just have fun. And so right now I'll be working until the end of the year, pretty much in the state. So like Cali, Texas, I'll hit New York, probably hit Florida again. But yeah, you know, Washington would be dope. But yeah, so I planned on being here until the end of the year. And then January comes, I'll go back to Australia again. Cause that's pretty cool. It's a really good time.
Let's talk about the business end of it. You know, so you're traveling a lot. Was that with, you know, just you, other comedians? You got who booked you? Talk about your journey with that. That's very exciting.
Yeah, it was definitely the time of my life. Last year when I first went, I was broke as hell, like the most broke I've ever been. I've always had two jobs. I've always had somewhat of a savings account, good credit, but when I kind of went full time with comedy in 2020, I basically was doing well for like 2 years between, like, I don't know, my side hustle, which is personal training, and running a winery show. I was doing that for 2 years, and then I ended up losing my winery show, which was a good chunk of my, you know, whatever. And I swiped a bunch of credit cards. So then now I got a bunch of credit card debt. But then I got much better at comedy. So it's like this weird exchange, you know? So last year, I'm all indie right now. I don't have an agent. I only have an acting agent. I don't have a stand-up agent or a manager yet. So I just booked it all myself, and I trusted that I can get connected enough that the following year when I come back, I can get paid enough to break even or to make some money, which I did. I ended up coming up with some money this year. Last year, broke as hell. I broke even, but I was dead broke when I came back. This year, I made some money, and then hopefully next year, I come home and do really well, but there's no telling. It's just the amount of how many tickets can I sell? Can I get a cool show name together? But I booked everything myself.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Does that help you, like, you know, by you doing it grassroots, then the second year was easier, the third year, because you got the relationship, you did well at that club, you know, the owner now. Is that how it's working for you?
Yeah. I was told, of course, by my other friends, you know, Lars Kellio, Canadian comic, Chris Franklin, they basically broke it down. They told me how things work. They said it's a gamble. If I go out there, there's no guarantee that, you know, I won't lose a bunch of money. But the people that I met out there were so lovely. All of them took care of. I was there 3 months last year. I only paid for accommodations for like 5 days. They all found me an extra room, a couch at mom's house, at their brother's house, another comedian's house. And from being there, that experience, all the material I wrote, all the connections I made, now I have connections in Europe, UK, Asia, all over the world because of that one trip. So for me, even though, you know, I lost some money, it was, the investment is 2,000% worth it. It's a dope opportunity. I want to be an international comic. I want to be able to adapt to any crowd that speaks English, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I just talked to a comedian that, Eric Schwartz, he, you know, Eric Schwartz,
Yeah, that's my boy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just talked to him like an hour ago. And he's like, yeah. He's like, I'm planning to do an all-Spanish comedy show.
Sick.
You know, no Anglo has ever done that. And I was like, that's awesome. That's like, you know. But back to you, though. When you go, what did that do for your skill set, for your you know, not just the rapport of the audience and your name, but how was it different in, let's say, Australia, the crowd? That's always fun to talk about. And then also, what did it do for you for your craft?
Man, the biggest differences that I noticed right away, number one, in America, if you say something on stage that's edgy or whatever, and it's not witty enough, you know, people can tense up from your you know, a little bit. But like in the streets in America, you know, there's repercussions for saying words. Like, words are fighting words out here. You know what I mean? You say the wrong thing in the wrong hood, it's like, all right, well, you got to fight now. Or there, it could be the other way too. Just triggered, offended, whatever.
Yeah.
But on stage, we're a lot more loose. We're familiar with comedy as Americans forever. We know what it is. We know well-behaved. We know what it is. In Australia, it's the opposite. So in the streets, in person, they'll be joking around with you, but they'll say some shit that you would fight in America. Like, I don't know. Like, one guy I met outside of a gym, I was with my friend Joe White, Australian comedian. I go outside, Joe's picking me up, and there's some guy that was in the gym, and he goes, hey, Frankie, this is my friend, blah, blah, blah. He was in the gym, and he goes, this is my friend Frankie from Mexico, ho, 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 like, he's from America, blah, blah. And then the guy goes, oh, did you jump over the wall? And I'm like, bruh, like, I know that he's joking, but I'm like, you haven't shook my hand, you don't know my name, like, I would have hit you in the chin back home. You know what I mean? Like, I'm from Eastside, San Jose. That shit is not cool. But again, I know that they're kidding. So of course, I'm just like, ha ha ha. And I just, you know, I respect the culture that's how they are. They just speak differently.
Right.
But I was just thinking that. And then on stage, Australians, they're more likely to tense up quick. If you do race stuff, if you do like midget, any keywords, you know, like things like that, they get real tense right away. But you're off stage, they're saying, oh, fag, retard, everything goes, you know?
Like the 90s in America.
Exactly, yeah. Which honestly, I enjoyed. It was refreshing that I didn't have to like tread lightly, you know?
Yeah, no one cared. I mean, somebody said something about you. I mean, that's the thing now. But you know, that's part of comedians, you know, you got to navigate towards the atmosphere of the world because that's our job. That's your job, right?
Yeah. You know, something fascinating. Sorry, real quick is, so when Chris Rock went out there, he bombed. Chris Rock.
In Australia?
Australia. Because he didn't speak about any Aussie culture. He didn't talk to them or with them. He just said, this is me and this is all my experience. Aussies want you to talk with them, about them, understand them. If you could do that and make a reference to them, it's like, all right, you're good to go now. But they have this tall poppy syndrome thing where it's like, we got to chop everybody down to size. Like, you're not important, kind. We're all one. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, so you can't really like talk down. You got to be with them. And once you figure that out, it's like, you're good.
That's how great Britain is. Did have you been ever
before? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't like the you know, tour over there with the American sass. Now, if you're a huge, it's like, well, he's Chris Rock, you know, that's no problem, you know, but nobody is like, who are you, you know? So what was that like performing over there?
In the UK?
Yeah.
Oh, it was cool. I mean, it was, they're just, their humor is different. In their eyes, everything's shit and you need to complain about it. If you sound too happy, fuck you, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I noticed it was just different and I had to adapt to it. In Australia, the UK, and even Asia, it's just different. So the way you communicate to them has to be different. Otherwise, you're going to struggle. And last year, it was like, I was honestly struggling with Australia and UK for those reasons. Because I'm like, I got golden retriever energy. You know what I mean? I'm a happy dude. And like, I'm not like shitting on things. And I had to understand their culture. it was just different. So it was fun as hell. It was interesting. I got better with riffing and crowd work, which they love. So it was a fun time figuring it out is what it was.
What are some things that stood out for you in Australia and Great Britain, you know, some gigs where you're like, that was an intro. That was one of the highlights.
And as far as,
you know, doing stand-up in the crowd, dealing with the crowd.
I could just feel how much they love crowd work. That's one of my favorite things is when you can kind of sniff out who wants it. And then you either start the interaction or they start the interaction and it's natural. It's different when you're like, you can feel when a comedian's being like, I said I'm going to practice my crowd work, so let me start an interaction. What's your name? You can feel that. Versus when there's an elephant in the room and you call it out, you know, somebody drops their beer glass and then you make a joke about it and then you continue to roll off of that. That's a more natural way. If somebody, you could tell somebody's, you know, they're responding to jokes or they have a weird laugh and then you get to have fun with that. I love those moments. And there was a lot of those in Scotland and in Australia.
What was the hell like? Yeah. You know, and how would you compare? What were the differences between Scotland? I love this. It's like eating cuisine, which you do it in the stab at different places. What was the difference between Scotland and Great Britain? Like, I remember, let's say London, where, you know, there's two different areas.
Yeah. I mean, I think British people in general and Aussies, they're funny. The fact that they're so loose culturally, it makes them funnier people because they're not trying to be a polite American citizen and the blah, blah, blah. They're just, they can't be fucked. They don't care. They're just fun. They're raw. They're like New York people. They're like New York black friends is what Aussies and UK people remind me of.
None.
So in that sense, it's like, they think they're funny and they are funny. So when you interact with them, sometimes their comebacks are hilarious.
Yeah.
So it's like, that shit is fun.
What was Scotland like?
Scotland was great for that reason because they're all just funny. Even their accent is already funny. And then the fact that they're so raw, they're just in your face. They don't care. You're bald, they'll say it. Like it's, you know what I mean? It's just raw and I love it.
Was there some things that you know, like, you know, your materials were, you know, totally worked here, but in China, tested it out over there and like, nah, that landed empty?
Yeah. I did a joke about texting and driving because Americans, that's all we do. Like, you're like, texting? What are you, a fucking preschooler? I'm on Netflix. I'm booking shows. I'm doing a story video. I'm promoting my shows. I'm doing everything in the car. But Australians have real repercussions for being on the phone. Like, you do three times texting, it's like your license is gone.
Wow.
And I said a joke about texting and driving that works really well here. Over there, like, no fucking funny kind. Like, they hated it. It was dead silent. And I was like, why? In my head. And I talked to my friend. I was like, why did this joke bomb? And he's like, dude, because we get fucked if we're speeding or we're on the phone. So nobody's on their phone when they're in Australia, not while they're driving.
I'm like drunk driving. He did a drunk driving joke. You thought texting was like more than it. No, they don't like that. That's to me, that's fascinating. To me,
yeah.
The difference of the cultures, you know, and navigating through that. Just dealing in the different parts of the United States, you know, because Northern California, where you're at, is going to be totally different than certain parts of Texas. I'm in Texas, by the way. I'm from LA. I'm from San Fernando Valley, but I live just north of Austin. And even doing stand-up in Austin compared to, let's say, 25 minutes north up in here in Georgetown is going to be different.
Right.
Right? And now, have you? What about you navigating through the country? What's been your experience with that?
Man, I mean, after going over there and coming back, it's the biggest comedy blessing, the fact that we have that we have so much diversity. When you go to Australia, it's like you got Perth, Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne, Tassie, Brisbane. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That's all you have to play with. And all of those share similar cultures and similar looking people. You go to America, you travel 20 miles and now it's a different looking crowd. References are different. The climate's different, the lifestyle. So we have so much more to play with. We have so much more population to reach when we're touring, when we put out stuff on online. We have a privilege of so much diversity, and that's what makes our country amazing. So I love the fact that we have that. Here in California, I'm in San Jose, I drive an hour, I'm in San Francisco. I drive another hour, I'm in wine country. I drive another hour, now I'm in weed country. I could drive 2 hours from here down, now I'm in a beach town, or I'm in Tahoe in the snow, now I'm in the mountains. Like, it's the greatest thing. So I really enjoy that. And I think that's the best part about being a comedian here.
What's your favorite spot to perform in at home?
And I really like the Sacramento is like Laughs Unlimited is my headline there on New Year's Eve. And it's like, you can't miss. Like, they're giving applause breaks. They're screaming. They're wooing. Washington, I loved as well. I did Spokane, Washington. They were same thing. The 30 minutes felt like 15. It's like they were just in, and they're laughing loud and generously. And then also there's nothing going on out there. So after the show, they're like, sign my hoodie, like sign anything. Like, you're a mate. Like, they make you feel like a megastar. And then you go to LA and they're like, what are you, the help? Like, are you cleaning? Are you doing the dishes? Like, we don't know who the fuck you are.
Right. Right. What about comedians right now? Who do you like? You know, who are you listening to? Who's been influential to you? You know,
Sam Morril, Mark Norman, Ralph Barbosa, of course, Cheng Wang, Dave Attell. Those are probably some of my top 10. And Louis C.K., now that things have sizzled down with the weirdness. Chappelle, of course. Those ones right there, though, are definitely like some of the top influences for sure. Some of my favorites.
Dave Attell, you know, he's so great. I don't hear that enough, you know, but he is like such a veteran. Ralph Barbosa, that's interesting. Kind of almost like you guys would go out for almost like the same parts sometimes, you know, like if you were casting, you know. Do you ever look at him and go, you can almost see yourself being cast in the same thing. It's like, what was the algorithm of like why he gets so big? I mean, he's great, don't get me wrong, but also you're great, you know, and it's like the algorithm, it's like, wow, this kid like skyrocketing. What do you think that was? You're great, plus what else?
Man, I just think he was ready. I think things happen as they're supposed to. And I think when you're ready, it, along with the combination of 1,000 factors of complexity that we'll never understand. But if you're one of those chosen ones and you're ready, that's when it happens. And I think at that time he was ready. He had enough material ready. And Don't Tell at the time was blowing up as well. So I think with that platform, it was enough to send him over. I think he had built a big ass, you know, the tower in Dubai, and then Don't Tell just toppled it over, and then just now it's over. Now he's blown up. And I think that's what it takes, is just one opportunity like that to get noticed.
Right. What's your long-term play? What's your 5, your 10, your 15-year plan? Do you plan out that far ahead? What's the big picture?
I have a lot of things in my vision, but I would say the first thing is I would love to have 3 specials that are truly special, and I'm not on any timeline for it because a special means something. It has a heavy definition. And then I would just love to have fans all over the world to where I can show up to a theater with 3,000 to 5,000 people and it's sold out no matter where I go. If I'm going to Paris or London or New York, LA, anywhere, and they pull up. And I would just love to be able to promote who I want to promote, put other people on, bring people on the road, put them in nice hotels and, you know, help pull them up, get them exposure, help businesses out, small businesses, by doing content for them. I enjoy doing content. I think it's really fun. And I would love to be like a mini Keith Lee, or maybe even as big or bigger, who knows? But Keith Lee is a foodie that really changes the lives of small businesses. And I would love to do that. I do that now on a small scale. I'll go to like, I went to a wing place in Perth, in Western Australia, some young Korean guy. And I tried the wings and I told him, yo, I've lived in LA and I've been all over, you know, a lot of countries all over the world. These are the best wings I've ever had. And he was like, oh, thank you so much. And I told him that I put them on my Instagram. Hopefully more people would come. And I showed him, you know, at the time I had like 15,000 followers. So for him, he was like, wow, like, oh, thank you. He gave me a free drink and he was just like blown away. And that's like priceless, you know? So I would love to do that on a bigger scale. Yeah. And yeah, movies would be great. I would love to be the first Mexipino superhero. I work really hard on my body. I got the body for it. You know, I'm hella athletic. Like, I'm funny. Superheroes are funny. Like, I think I could do that eventually at some point. As long as it's within the next 7 years, I could still look like a young superhero. I got some time now, but yeah, I would love to open a comedy club later on when I'm retired and do what Joe Rogan's doing type of thing, where you just are very generous with the hosts and the features, you know? So yeah, just kind of just put people on, have a really successful career around the world and just have like a hot 10 years in the game, you know, like where I'm on fire 10 years, you know?
That all sounds doable. And yeah. It sounds like you're on your way, you know? You keep our team sharing your body and your mind, keep on honing your craft, look for new opportunities, and you're on your way, man. I love it. Tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
Yeah, appreciate it. All the socials are under Frankie with the IE, Frankie M Comedy. Yeah, YouTube, TikTok, IG, all that. And yeah, I'm just starting the journey, man. Just warming up, but I'm excited to share it, you know, with you and with everybody, all the amazing humans I've met. So yeah, I'll be around for a while.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you so much for sharing great stuff.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you.
All right. That's a wrap for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed our adventure and we inspired you to go on your own. Special thanks to our sponsor, Bolitor. Remember, whether you're trekking through the wilderness or commuting to work, Bolitor's unique backpacks and outdoor gear ensure you're always prepared for the journey. Check it out at bolitor.com. That's bolotor.com. Check it out and gear up for your next adventure. Until next time, stay curious and keep on exploring.